Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. If you've listened to other episodes of this podcast, you've likely heard me say that the challenges with product management and creating products customers love is not actually the development. You know, it's not always easy, but we generally know how to get products developed. The real challenge is knowing what to develop, that product that customers value. This is the realm of designing for the user and specifically the user experience. So today, I'm really glad to have a guest that is an expert in designing user experiences, Mark Caper. Mark has over 20 years of experience refining his craft of user-centered product development and innovation across the spectrum of organizations, from startups to several Fortune 100 companies, including names you know like PepsiCo, Johnson & Johnson, and Microsoft. He is the founder of Compass Strategy, an innovation agency located in Santa Monica, California. Mark, thanks for discussing innovation with me today.
Hi, Chad. Yeah, thank you for having me on the show.
We met a while ago at a workshop where we were both learning about value innovation, which I kind of characterize as a more action-oriented approach to blue ocean strategy. And you know, during kind of the interactions we had, you stood out as a person with deep experience and knowledge conducting customer research. So let's kind of start there. With I hear lots of different terms, you know, used with this customer research context. Context is designing for the user, designing for the customer, user experience design, UX, design thinking, lean thinking, you know, there's all these terms. How do you describe your approach to designing for the customer?
Well, all of those are interesting terms. I think they all have a role. Some of them are kind of more defined and some of them are less defined. But when we think about what we're trying to really achieve for our clients is we're trying to design ideally truly meaningful products and meaningful experiences for customers. Most businesses only really achieve, you know, development of functional, reliable, usable products, which are kind of nice and they achieve some success in the marketplace, but they're easily leapfrogged because if you're focusing on function and you're focusing on reliability or usability, you know, someone's going to come along and leapfrog you eventually. So to create, you know, our goal is to really create meaningful products. If we create meaningful products, then they form special bonds with consumers at a very deep level. They bond with the sense of self of the consumer. And research has shown, actually real true, you know, empirical research with, you know, quantitative numbers of respondents have shown that meaningful products really achieve a higher price point. They achieve more loyalty, and customers are more willing to talk about those products with their friends, more willing to blog about those products and share those products on social media. So there's a lot of benefit in having these kind of meaningful interactions with products, and you know, it really leads to long-lasting success for an organization. So all of those other tools that you mentioned, you know, tools like you know, user experience design is really a way to get to it. Design thinking is something you have in your quiver that, you know, really should be part of your process, but really at the end of the day, the objective should be to elevate the experience to that point of, you know, highly pleasurable or even truly meaningful experiences.
Okay, so we're going beyond products with features that create benefits for the user. And even I often use the language of just value, right? That we're creating more value for a customer than their alternatives they have available to them. To this notion of meaningful, which I like the way you phrase that, that we're creating a connection and really kind of an emotional bond with the product.
Yes, and it works in both B2B or B2C markets, consumer markets, as well as business markets. Because at the end of the day, the buyer who's buying or specifying a product for a business is a human being, and he's truly looking for something, he or she is truly looking for something that's going to satisfy kind of deep-seated emotional needs, whether that need is to make sure that I still have a job after I specify this product or doing something really amazing for my organization. they have deep-seated emotional needs that that really drive their decisions in the marketplace.
Yeah, no one wants to get fired for bringing in the wrong solution in a B2B context.
Right.
So pretty important. And, you know, as a gadget guy, as you talk about that, what meaningful really means, you know, the first example that comes to my mind is the Apple iPod, because I remember when that was coming about, right? I probably had three MP3 players, you know, on a counter somewhere in my home. But when the iPod came about, it was this new, beautifully designed, different sort of thing that did all the stuff my existing MP3 players did, but somehow I was more connected to it. Is that the sort of thing we're talking about?
Yeah, I think the iPod is really a manifestation of something that's much bigger, and that's the Apple brand. And the Apple brand really stands for something that's deep and meaningful in people's lives. You know, Apple, the brand really kind of came into its own, you know, with that famous 1984 television ad, that kind of Orwellian ad where the woman runs into this theater and everybody's in black and white and looks like 1984. And she throws the big hammer at the screen where Big Brother is, and the screen blows up and everybody turns into color and they all leave the theater. And it's the idea of really, you know, Apple is freeing you from being a corporate drone, and it's allowing you to express yourself, and it's allowing you to be more, to be more creative. And, so that's really deep seated. And so when you have that kind of brand meaning, it not only connects to your customers, but it also drives your internal organization. You know, you set these kind of high goals of meaning. And I think the iPod, the iPhone, the MacBook Pro, you know, the watch, all of these things that Apple does, you know, kind of evolves first out of that deep seated meaning that they share both internally within the organization as well as with their customer.
Right. Yeah. And this is other products too. My, you know, wife has shared with me that she loves her Toyota minivan, right? She has this affinity for the minivan that, you know, the next car will probably have to be a Toyota just because of this previous experience. So when it comes to creating these meaningful products, what are the tools involved here? You know, what kind of tools do you use in understanding that user experience to create meaning for them?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the key things is to really understand what is meaningful to, you know, to a customer. There's a lot of clues out there in culture around what's meaningful to your customer. So one of the first tools that we use is looking at cultural trends, looking at kind of emergent things that are happening in movies. It could be in advertising. It could be in, just articles in the paper. It could be cultural movements. We see this kind of big kind of cultural pushback right now against big organizations, big food, in some ways, maybe big government. You know, we saw the movement, you know, against Wall Street in the park, you know,
the 99ers.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. You know, all of those things are cultural trends that have a lot of meaning. And then as a response to that, now we see, you know, organizations trying to make their brands have more integrity. So we see, you know, Chipotle trying to, you know, go for the kind of idea of integrity in their food and all of those types of things. So that's the first step, is really to start off and try to understand what are those things in culture that's truly meaningful for people and which ones are relevant to our product or brand. And then, you know, then we can move into the world of kind of consumer insights and start doing in-depth research with the customer and understand which of those things really deeply resonate. And the truly most meaningful ones are the ones where they respond, you know, yeah, that's how I feel, and nobody else gets me. Because when somebody says, you know, that's me, that's how I feel, and I believe in that, but nobody else gets me, what they're really looking for is, you know, a brand or a product that can resolve that need for them to express, you know, what they're seeking. So that's a big part of it. And I think, you know, that's a very kind of emotional and very kind of cultural level of connection to the consumer that most companies are unwilling to get to. You know, we see companies like Harley Davidson, BMW, Apple, you know, they have that kind of connection with their customers. And but a lot of companies are really still dealing on this kind of rational, functional, you know, how many cup holders, how big is the engine, you know, is, you know, those types of questions. And it's really about, you know, driving to these kind of higher level purposes.
Okay. So the two things there, you talked about identifying the culture relevance, what's going on in the culture right now, and talked about trends some. And trends is something that comes up a lot in the interviews when I talk to people involved in innovation. You know, what is the trend that we need to be paying attention to get, but become a part of, to capture that? And then capturing the consumer insights. How do you actually go about this then? What's the kind of, you know, what are you doing to understand what's going on in the culture and make sense of that and learn what to apply there to make meaning for a product?
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of different levels that we use for the cultural research. If we're working with a client and we're looking at kind of longer horizon opportunities, you know, 10 to 20 years in the future, we'll look at, you know, what are the driving forces that are shaping the world relevant to the market for that company's products or services. And we look across, you know, this steep framework, you know, social, technological, environmental, economical, and political framework. And we look at trends and driving forces across that entire framework. If we're looking for something that's nearer in, like if we're working with a CPG company, maybe looking for platforms for development for new food and beverages, then we're looking kind of closer in. You know, we're looking at, you know, again, what are the kind of the key trends and driving forces that are really shaping attitudes? And we're looking for more kind of emergent attitudes. You know, so we're, again, you know, it's cultural scanning. You know, we bring in a lot of kind of interns that can, you know, go through social media. They can go through, you know, blogs. They can, you know, look through, you know, different articles, different forums, different newspapers and things like that, and just uncover as many kind of different themes as we can uncover. And then we've got this list of themes. Once we have that list of trends and those list of themes, then we can go to the, you know, to the actual customers. And the preferable way to do this with customers is to do it in their homes, wherever that place is that's really relevant to the product. If it's a workplace product, it may be more relevant to try to get into the workplace. If it's something that connects to their home, then their home. But we want to get into that kind of environment of use and that context of use of the product, and then start to engage with them about what's really meaningful first at a very high level, what's meaningful in their lives, what are those things in culture that's kind of bothering them, and then start to move down into the category. What's bothering you about food today? What's bothering you about cars today? What are you wrestling with? We actually just did a great study for a company in kind of the performance automobile space, and we were talking to their customers, and one of the big kind of cultural issues that they have is, you know, they really don't like CAFE standards, and they really want high performance big V8 cars, you know, and they want to be able to take their car to the racetrack and drive it on the racetrack and do competitive lap times and then be able to drive that car on the street. And they feel like culture is working against them, and you know, because of the CAFE standards and noise restrictions and things like that, you know, they're limited in what they can do. So, you know, that's a perfect opportunity for innovation. It's like, okay, so how do we meet that customer's needs that really wants that big V8 feeling, that really, that's a really important part of their life, but they also, you know, we really in the real world, we have to sell that product in a market with, you know, with environmental regulations and fuel efficiency and all of the other things that, all those other factors.
Right. Yeah, there's often real-world constraints we need to fit any product to and just manage that. So when it comes to, you know, doing some of this research, it sounds like this starts with qualitative sort of research where you're trying to identify the themes maybe in social media related to your customer group and looking for how they talk about things, right?
That's correct. Yeah, qualitative, especially deep qualitative, is very useful. early on in the process. You know, quantitative is great once you've understand what are these key factors. Once you get kind of this big list of key factors, then you can move into quantitative. And segmentation is a great tool, market segmentation up front, not on kind of demographics and things like that, but really market segmentation on kind of mindset and attitudes, and use these things that you uncover through the trend research and the qualitative research to formulate your segments. And then once you've gone through that quantitative process, you've formulated those segments, then you can start to see which segments align best with your brand, which segments, you know, are large enough for you to, you know, to target and try to capture. And then are there other segments around that target segment that you may be able to pick up, you know, through, you know, just, you know, once the product goes to market, you know, a lot of times a very strong personality product will start to draw customers in from other segments. But usually we start with a very single-minded target. You know, when we do a segmentation, we'll pick a specific target and characterize that target very deeply. And then we'll focus in on that target for the product development process. And then later on, we'll come back and we'll test to see, is that product not only appealing to that segment, but also pulling from other segments as well.
Okay. And then we move into interviews or observations with actual customers in their environment to really dig deeper. But I still want to dwell in on the culture aspect a little bit more. Because I can imagine if it's a product that you're trying, that you're working with to try to add meaning to, you know, maybe it's the next generation of the product, and how do we improve this so people really connect to it? Hyundai did this once with their Santa Fe sport utility vehicle, and how to improve that so people actually do feel connection. At least then I know where to kind of go to look at themes that I might, you know, where I might find them in social media. I'm thinking if it's a brand new product, how do I kind of start? Where do I find to even start my research about uncovering themes?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So if we're trying to really do truly breakthrough innovation, let's say that we're looking at a category like recreational vehicles, and there's, you know, you can buy a motorcycle, you can buy a boat, you can buy personal watercraft. There's all of those things out there, and you're saying, well, I want to do something completely different. Mm-hmm. What we really want to do then is we want to go out and we want to look for the people who are seeking the benefits that that category can offer, but they're rejecting the offerings that are currently in that category. We call them, you know, rejectors, but they're rejectors. They're not just rejectors because, you know, they just don't like motorized vehicles or, you know, things that are recreational in nature. They really like this stuff, but they're rejecting it. There's some reason that these products aren't meeting their needs. And then we do in-depth interviews with those people and find out, you know, what is it about, you know, the current offerings in those categories that's causing them to reject. And then we create a long laundry list of those things. And then, you know, we can, once we have that long laundry list, again, segmentation is a great tool to find out how many people are sharing those unmet needs and what are those people like.
That makes a lot of sense to me, this category of the rejectors that are still looking to fulfill a need that hasn't been made yet. And so once you kind of figure out that's the right approach, then is this just, you know, you find your intern that is really good at doing social media searches, or are you going to the mall and you're trying to find people that, you know, are unsatisfied? How do you actually find the real people?
Yeah. Well, we have the luxury, you know, our clients are usually, you know, able to afford, you know, the recruitment process that we would typically use for qualitative research, you know, where we create a screening questionnaire, and then we would go to a focus group facility. But instead of having them recruit for focus groups, we'd have them recruit for in-home ethnography. Hmm. We create a screening questionnaire, and part of that questionnaire is, you know, those questions around attitudinal questions. You know, I would enjoy, you know, the benefits of these activities, but then it's also those, you know, but I'm not purchasing, you know, I'm not in the category. And a lot of times too, we want, you know, there are those people that are, they can't afford it. That's, you know, that could be an unmet need that we want to solve, but You know, we just have to be careful that we want to screen to get those people who have, you know, the kind of unmet needs that we want to solve. So if we're looking for sedan rejectors, we have to first make sure, yeah, they can afford a car, and they shopped for the sedan and they couldn't find a sedan that they wanted and then they bought something else. So we screen for those people, we recruit those people, and then we want to go in their homes and do ethnographic research to find out what their lives are like. And then we can find out a lot of things that are would be unspoken in a focus group. We can see things in their lives that we couldn't even imagine asking questions about in a focus group, but because we're in that context where we can actually see what the context of their life is all about, then, you know, it brings to mind kind of new reasons why those existing products didn't meet their needs.
Right. Yeah. So much can be uncovered in those one-on-one experiences, and actually working with the customers. And I don't know if you've done this before. As you talked through that, I was thinking that, driving paid traffic to a landing page might be a technique to try to uncover some of these rejectors, that if you could come up with the right characterization of the ad that captured their attention, you know, are you still looking for that perfect water sport activity and you haven't found it yet, right? Whatever it would be. And that people would then click to a landing page and maybe, you know, then go through that screening survey. I don't know if that would work or not. I'm just kind of talking out loud here thinking out loud about it. Have you done anything like that or experienced with that?
I have not, but actually that's a very interesting idea.
Clearly working with the established screening groups that do focus groups and identify customers, I know is a proven recipe, and just thinking of other ways to crack this nut too. So
yeah, well, you're talking about lean thinking and how do we, quite often we have clients that don't have a lot of budget. And like I was kind of alluding to, you know, going out and hiring a firm to do the recruitment for you and then paying incentives, that can be expensive. So these ideas, you know, these kind of more guerrilla ideas are great ideas.
And I know we could keep talking about tools to how to specifically get some of these things done, but I think that might get teased out some in a specific example. So could you walk us through the real world story of, you know, where it started and where you ended up with in terms of a product?
Yeah, so an example of that goes through this whole process would be the Panasonic electric lady shaver. I worked with this when I was the head of strategy and research for Hauser, which was a design firm in Los Angeles at the time. And the client came to us because they had very small market share in the electric shaver space for women at the time, and they wanted to increase the market share, but they didn't know, you know, what the problem was with their current product and why it was being rejected. So we began this process with ethnographic research. We had a team of a anthropologist who had some experience with the design world, and designers together would go out in the field and they would talk to women about electric shavers, and then they would observe women shaving and talk about that shaving process. And we also, at the same time, you know, we use that experience to gather a lot of photographs about bathrooms and to understand the context of use and purchase decision and all of that stuff. We, you know, these were 2-hour interviews, so we gathered a lot of information. But the real kind of key things came out about, you know, what was it that made a shaver good or a shaver not good, and what was it that that made an electric shaver work or didn't work. We recruited some people who were using blade shavers and some that were using electric shavers. And we learned a lot of interesting things. One thing that was really key for Panasonic that we learned was that their brand promise about wet and dry, the Panasonic brand and shavers at the time was really known that you could use it in a wet environment and you would get a very good shave in a wet environment. You could use it in the shower, in the bathtub, or whatever. It was a waterproof shaver, and it was brilliant because people associated waterproof shavers with getting a really close shave. But what they didn't associate with with Waterproof was the Panasonic Electric Lady Shaver. Because of the product had really very shiny plastic. It was kind of a white, pearlescent, shiny plastic product. It was very beautiful plastic. It looked very nice. Because of that kind of shininess to the plastic, they thought if they were in the shower and they use this in the shower and they dropped it, it would break. It didn't look robust or rugged enough to be used in the shower. And then in addition to that, we learned a lot about the shaving experience. We had people kind of walk through the shaving experience when they were shaving their legs. And, you know, what was it that they were really looking for? What were the really hard spots to get to? And, you know, we looked at the ergonomics about how they were holding the shaver and things like that. And so we got a lot of the details that really kind of informed the design process. Then we went to work and we did a segmentation study. And so we had a whole long list of unmet needs. We had a lot of information about what people were seeking at this kind of more emotional level about shaving. What was their kind of fundamental motivation even for shaving? Which we gathered that through the ethnographic research too. And then based on those fundamental motivations for shaving and their ideal shaving experience, we created, you know, these segments, and we found that there were several segments that were willing to, they're highly motivated shavers. They really wanted to look good. They wanted to feel good. Shaving was really important to them. They had interest in Electric Lady Shavers, and they were open to the Panasonic brand. And so we focused in on those targets. And so we did additional research, both in homes and focus groups, to more deeply profile those users. And at the same time, we started to do some concept design. So the industrial designers went to work on some concept designs for those products as well. We got through the concept design phase and that segment profiling research phase, and then went into a concept test. And so we did an online quantitative concept test as well as a qualitative study to evaluate the concepts that we developed. And we found some promising concept directions through the qualitative work. And it's really nice when you can do quant and qual at this kind of concept stage. In the concept stage, we were able to identify even ways that we could enhance these designs even more. And so we narrowed it down to two design directions at that point, moved those forward and did a second round of concept testing. And then after that, we had, identified really what the ideal product was. But I think in the end, what we really learned was there were people out there that really, they felt that their looks was very important to them. There are people who are going out to nightclubs, they were dating, they were very social. Their aesthetic beauty was very important to them. And they believed that this wet, dry promise would meet that deep-seated need, again, that meaningful need, that deep-seated emotional need of making them more beautiful, giving them a better shave. And then it was a matter of finding the right design, giving that design vocabulary the right vocabulary so that it connected with them and who they were and substantiated the benefit of being able to be used in a wet and dry environment. In other words, it didn't look like it was going to break if it fell out of your hand. I think that's a really key lever that people in marketing often forget, is that often design is undervalued as a tool. And a lot of times, you can say that a product is wet and dry, and you can advertise that it's wet and dry, and you can spend a lot of money on communications around that. But if the design language doesn't match the promise of the product, you should be able to look at the design of a product and it should tell you the story of the product without even having communications. You know, that's really our ideal. Yeah.
And earlier, Mark, when you shared about, dropping the razor, I got it, right? Because when you're talking about the shiny white plastic, I'm like, why would this make it seem like it wasn't a wet razor? But if you're in the shower, of course you're going to drop the razor. That just happens.
Right,
And they get that connection. So I want to break this down a little bit. First, I have to say, you must be in a really small club, because there can't be that many men in the world that know so much about lady electric razors. Right? I mean, this doesn't happen that much. So breaking down the steps there, the overall problem that was first being pursued was, low market share for this razor, and how can we improve that? And then you got involved in doing the ethnographic research, those user observations to actually talk with women using razors, electric razors, blade razors. What's the difference there? What were the ergonomics that were involved with using the razors? And so that all makes sense to me, that directly impacts the design, the physical design, the features, and then the related benefits of the razor. But then he also talked about exploring the motivation for shaving. And it sounded like, as you described that more, that really impacted the messaging for the product. Was there any impacts to the actual design of the product too, that motivation for shaving?
Yeah, it really defined the target. If we think about segmentation, and we think about the axes in a segmentation, and this particular segmentation, on one axis, the y-axis, there was the highly motivated shavers, the highly involved shaver. Shaving was really important to them. And then, down at the bottom, there was the uninvolved. And then if you look at the highly involved, so those highly involved people, to some, the idea of being highly involved in shaving was more of this kind of ritual, kind of soothing, it's a pampering process. It's, I'm going to, light some candles. I'm going to draw a bath, kind of experience. And it was really difficult to move those people off of a blade shaver to an electric shaver, because that blade shaver was so deeply ingrained with that experience. And electric, of course, doesn't fit well with candle lights and soft music. But the other side of the segmentation, over on the top right side, we had this target that was, in a hurry. She had a busy lifestyle. She had a job, and then at the end of the day, she wanted to, shave quickly, take a quick shower, and then go out for the evening. So that helped us really understand the target. And then also, because these women tended to be kind of more kind of modern, kind of into more kind of progressive design, it had a big influence on it gave a lot of liberty to the design team to kind of move off of kind of more classic or traditional design references and push the design out for these younger women who were into kind of stylish and more modern products.
Very good. So the understanding the motivation for shaving actually did go back and impact the product design too, not just the messaging.
That's correct.
Sounds like some really important insights, and you learn more about Lady Razors than you ever wanted to know, probably. So lots of things there that we could tease out further. I'm curious about, is there a, for people listening to this that have a group that they would like to explore this issue of, how do we think about our product design and the problems customers have to create products that are meaningful? Are there steps that you go through? Have you led a group? I mean, obviously you do this as a consulting company, but for a group that wants to kind of explore this themselves, what would you tell them? Could we construct a little mini seminar right now for them?
Sure. So there's a couple of ways, to go about this. One thing that I've seen happen that works quite nicely, I've seen, companies go to agencies that are expert in this, and then those agencies kind of walk them through the first couple of projects, and then before long, these companies are kind of up and running on their own. But there's a lot of small organizations out there that are kind of lean thinking, again, that really want to to learn how to do this on their own. And so the most important thing, to do first, is to really think first about what is it that we're focused on. So we can't focus on the whole kind of marketplace or the whole kind of business of the organization at this point. When we're at this level of innovation, we're focusing in on a specific area of need. So this assumes that the organization has some strategic plan. It's time to refresh this product, or it's time to kind of explore this area. So we're assuming that they've got a focus. You know, they wanted to increase market share in electric lady shavers, or they want to innovate in the sedan category, or they want to create a new lodging experience that's different than the W or the, you know, the Westin or something else. So we got a focus here. And then once we have a focus, so let's say that a focus, for instance, we've done a couple of seminars on this, one at an ASTM conference and another one at a different conference, that, you know, we focused in on like examples, like let's redesign the Starbucks experience, or redesign, let's design a lodging experience for Virgin. If we're working inside of an organization, I'd focus in on a real problem within your organization and use a product development process to really focus in on this. And what we want to do first is we want to go out and look in topics in social media, recently published books, what's going on in the blogs, what are politicians talking about that might be relevant to your space? What's some of the big kind of controversies in culture? Are there new TV shows with a growing following? You know, are there movies that evoke controversy? Start to kind of research the culture around the space. You know, so the first part is cultural scanning, and make a list of those kind of cultural trends or cultural those cultural themes that are relevant to your product area. Then we want to involve the customer. So at this, then we want to go out and we want to do those that kind of deep ethnography. If you want to practice this, you can practice this on people within your organization. The problem with using people within your organization for research is ultimately they're going to be biased at some point. But early in the process, if you want to exploring with people in your family, exploring with people in your organization is fine. It's just later in the process when it comes down to concept testing or what, there's always these inherent, maybe even subconscious bias that we want to avoid. But at this point in time, we need to empathize with people. We need to go out and we need to understand what they're thinking. So we want to understand of all of these kind of themes around their product area, what are the ones that are the most meaningful? And so we want to go in and we want to understand their aspirations and actions, and we want to understand their emotional point of view. So we really want to, ask very kind of open-ended questions. We always start with the big things, like, you know, when you just what's on your mind, you know, what in the world today is really bothering you, and then start to channel down into the space. If we're talking about a Starbucks experience, it's about, you know, when is it that you really want to have that Starbucks experience, but you can't? You know, there's no Starbucks around. You know, what are those times mm-hmm. when you can think of when you wanted a Starbucks, but you couldn't have one? Or if we're thinking about the new lodging experience, it's about, you know, think about, you know, your life and how could a lodging experience better express who you are and what's important to you in your life. And so we do this kind of open-ended probing. We may even, you know, have them before we go into that meeting, we may have them do a collage. So a lot of times we'll ask respondents to collage for us. What is their ideal experience in this category? What would be their ideal lodging experience? What would be their ideal coffee experience? And the reason that we have them use a collage is because, you know, there's this old saying that a picture is worth a thousand words. And the reason that a picture is worth a thousand words is because our linguistic vocabulary is very limited, but our visual vocabulary is nearly boundless. And so we can learn a lot through our visual vocabulary. There are things that we can learn that are very, very difficult to express linguistically. And so when we have them collage, a lot of things that we see in those collages are kind of channeled from their unconscious mind, things that they can't express or things that they don't even know how to express linguistically.
Mark, when you help someone do that, do you give them tools to start with? Like, do you give them a set of images to start with, or is it just, you know, go put this together?
Yeah, we do both. We would normally go have them do a pre-exercise for us before we start the research event. We would have them go out on the internet, go into magazines, wherever they want, and have them open-endedly find images. and use whatever images they want. And the reason that we want to do it so open-endedly is we want to uncover those themes and trends that we didn't think about. There may be things that they're pulling into these collages that we didn't even anticipate. So that's why we want to do that very open-endedly. But at the same time, when we get into the research event, we like to have a portfolio of images that we've actually selected. And we like to use images as a tool because, again, images kind of bypass the kind of cortex thinking and bypass the kind of logical part of the brain and connect more with the emotional part of the brain. And so if we say, you know, well, let's think about this ideal coffee drinking experience. Which of these images would you associate with your ideal coffee drinking experience? And then we can, you know, we can use those images to help kind of navigate which of the themes that we were thinking of resonated the most. And the reason that this is important to use the images is, you know, is it really kind of, you know, somebody might say, you know, well, you know, this isn't important to me. Logically, you know, I might say, I'm just really basic. I just want a cup of coffee, you know, cheapest cup of coffee is fine. But then when I see an image and it's, you know, it shows like a coffee shop setting, you know, and I kind of look at this whole environment, I might not think about that as a cup of coffee. I might think about that as another place. I might think about that as a place that has some significance to me.
And let's do this real quick for all the everyday innovators listening. Think right now, what is your ideal coffee drinking situation? And I suspect just in that brief instance there that one came to your mind, because I know when you said it before, I saw myself in a certain coffee shop, you know, standing next to the standing bar there, you know, with my preferred beverage of coffee, right? And so I was even looking at a picture, but I had that imagery come to mind. And that's if you can capture that, get that out of people's heads and capture that as part of this design process, that's very powerful.
Yes. Yeah, that is very powerful. And so coming out of this kind of qualitative research, so let's say that you find, you know, 10 people within your company or between your company, your organization, and, you know, your friends and family, you find 10 people and you go through this process, you're going to get a lot of information. And what we want to do is write down on post-it notes, you know, we use, you know, the 3x5 post-it notes, and we use markers, you know, with a kind of broad tip marker so you can stand 3 feet away from the wall and still read it. And we write down, you know, what are these key themes that came out of the research? You know, what did we learn? What are these key themes? What really connected with people? And then we just take a big wall and we just put all these post-its on the wall. And then we start to cluster them together, and we're trying to cluster them into things that we would call platforms. And these platforms are things that that connect together, that they kind of fit together into certain types of experiences. You know, the coffee on the run, the relaxing cup of coffee, the pick me up in the afternoon coffee, there's all of these different kind of coffee platforms. And so we kind of cluster these together into these platforms. And then we can step back and we can say, okay, you know, which of these platforms are occupied, you know, and which are the spaces that are open? Are there any blue ocean spaces here that we didn't, that aren't occupied? Are there any spaces here that we want to play in? You know, we can start to make some strategic decisions about, you know, these different kind of platforms. And then it helps us to kind of define some focus, you know, for further exploration. Mm-hmm. What we want to do once we identify which platforms we want to move forward is then we have to write like a short description of that platform in a way that the customer would understand. And so we need to describe, we're essentially writing a short kind of positioning statement, but we're using language that the customer would use. Because in the end, what we want to do is we want to describe each of these platforms independently on each in a separate kind of sheet of paper with a separate little paragraph describing each one, because we want to eventually go back out to customers and have them read this statement, this positioning statement, or the description of this platform, and then tell us, you know, how that feels to them. Is that something that really connects with them? Is it really meaningful to them? You know, so we want to use these kind of descriptions to help us, again, determine which, you know, which way we should go and which way we shouldn't go. Also, how do we optimize these? Can we optimize and refine these? A lot of times at this point, too, like with CPG products, once we get these platforms written, we might actually start doing some design sketches of maybe a product. So if we're working in Electric Lady Shavers and we have these different shaving experiences, we might sketch, you know, four or five different concepts that might fit with that experience. And so then we can, when we're in the research setting, we can say, okay, which of these platforms, or we don't call them platforms, but which of these ideas connects with you? And then for those respondents that like a specific idea, then we can show them a set of product ideas and say, you know, do these fit? You know, which ones fit the best? You know, which ones really match that concept? So that's really the next step, is start to, you know, work with those platforms, develop some expressions, some visual expressions of those platforms in product design, and even, you know, possibly some visual expressions, you know, from other media, even just imagery. You know, we can go into a group and ask them to, you know, we can read them a statement about an experience and then have them select images that bring that experience to life again. So we can start to, you know, inform ourselves more and more about what is really the essence of that experience.
Very good. So, so not necessarily in your terminology, but the steps I captured here was, you know, first up, what is the focus? Second was really secondary research, was around that cultural scanning. You know, let's make use of the sources already available and look for the cultural issues. Third up was the ethnography, actually doing the user observations and talking to real people, and really with a focus on trying to find out what are the most meaningful themes. And then fourth up I had is collecting that key theme information and doing the affinity diagram exercise, right, with all the little post-it notes on the wall and organizing that into platforms, you know, places where we can compete, where we choose to compete. And then, again, my words, you didn't say concept testing, but as you talked about it, I thought fifth was concept testing, putting together something that fleshes out the concept. And then finally, the last one was more concept prototyping and getting feedback again from real people on those prototypes.
Yeah. I think one of the key things, you know, a key takeaway here is there's two elements here that we really need to test when we're moving these ideas forward. One is, does the overall idea resonate? Mm-hmm. And then the second is, you know, does the expression or the idea that we're, you know, that the product or the concept that we're pursuing, does it really satisfy, you know, that description? Because a lot of times what we see in concept testing is you could have a great idea, but the product that you're showing doesn't really resonate with the customer. So you've got, you know, great idea or bad product, or you could have a bad idea. And if you have a bad idea, then, you know, there's no product that's going to really fit that. But quite often we see kind of the companies throw the baby out with the bathwater. They got a great idea, but they do, you know, too few executions of that idea and none of the executions work. And then they just assume, it was a bad idea to begin with. And they don't, because they didn't explore that, the expression of that idea, you know, enough, you know. So it's important to look at both of those. Do we have a good idea? And then are we on the right track in satisfying, you know, that need?
Excellent. And thanks for walking through those steps. And those could be something that a group could make a little mini seminar about and, you know, work as a group. And you shared that you've done this at a couple conferences. Do you have a handout available that we could share with listeners to help with this?
Yes, we did a handout for the ASTM conference that we can modify a bit. So I think that would be perfect for this.
Excellent. So Everyday Innovators, come to the show notes for this episode, and you will find a link to that handout to help you out with that. So Mark, this has been super useful talking through the steps that you took and learning about Ladies Electric Razors and how to make that a meaningful product and redesign that. And now talking through those steps we just went through, again, how do you uncover the cultural norms for that target audience that you're trying to reach and identify new opportunities that you can play in a way that actually does capture meaning for customers in a product? I like wrapping up our interview time always asking my guests for an innovation or success quote. What is one that you really like and why did you choose that one?
Yeah, this is from... professor at the University of Southern California Marshall School of Business. His name is Gerald Tellis. He wrote a book called Unrelenting Innovation, which is a great book that's based on real research into over 700 companies and identifying what helps companies be successful in innovation. And his the quote is from his book, and it's, "The cause of failure and the impediment to success lies not in hard formula, models, technologies, buildings, or dollars, but in a soft, mushy, difficult to grasp, and tough to master thing called culture." Mm-hmm. And the reason I like that is because I've been through this process of innovation with clients over and over and over again, and I've been a visitor to many different cultures. And really the key impediments that I've seen to companies in innovation and also the key criteria for success in innovation is the culture. You know, the company has to be able to, have a willingness to cannibalize their own products. They have to be able to embrace risk. They have to have a focus on the future. They have to have right alignment of incentives in order to get innovation through the system. And they have to empower innovation champions. Those are really the key elements of success. And if you don't have that, then the chances are that no matter how much time you spend on these tools like user experience design and design thinking and things like that, you won't achieve success. It really comes through really the way the culture perceives risk and their focus on innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. Great quote. And culture will either support it or it will kill it, right? It will do one or the other. And having a culture that supports it is what we want to foster. Well, thanks so much. Excellent tips, excellent methodology to really create meaningful products. For people that want to learn more about your work and follow what you do, how can they do that?
We actually have a really good blog on our website. Our website is www.compassstrategy. So it's compass with a K and then strategy, just two S's in the middle. But the blog, we try to keep it up to date with interesting things in the world of innovation, examples and ideas. So it's a great place to visit. And we'll be launching a new website towards the end of June. So it'll even be better in late June.
And actually, by the time listeners are listening to this, it's probably already up. So they can check it out.
Okay.
Very good. So the website, any other contact information you want to share?
It's all on the website. If you want to reach me, it's Mark, M-A-R-K, at compassstrategy.com as well. Feel free to contact me. Think of me as Google. If you have any questions about innovation, feel free to ask.
Great. Mark, I appreciate your time. Once again, Everyday Innovators, thank you so much for listening to this. Please let us know how we can help you learn more about product innovation and product management through these podcasts. And just reach out to me at theeverydayinnovator.com. When you go to that will take you to the company site. And there's a contact form there. And let us know how we can provide more value in these episodes. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training your customers will love you for. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.